This session is entitled with tongue-in-cheek, Storytelling for Campers and Other Christians, making an assumption, of course, at that point. I want to do several things today. I'd like to give you a very brief rationale for storytelling and why it ought to be at the heart of camping as well as the heart of the church. But since I'm talking primarily to campers, we'll make that statement. And then I want to look at two forms of stories that I think are apropos for the camp setting. There are many other kinds, too. I'll make reference to a couple of them, but in an hour's time, we're limited, and I want to leave a good time at the end for discussion, because I think the implications of this are pretty broad for where you folks are coming from. I also am going to assume that almost everybody in here has told stories at one time or another. The way that you live is, first of all, a way of by story. When you go home, you will be telling stories to people about your experiences. That's the informal method. I'm also going to assume that at camp, your camp experiences have many, many stories, both those that are kind of mythical in nature. Well, look at that old rock up in the hill. Let me tell you about that, or whatever else it happens to be. As well as the stories of the gospel and other kinds. There are two Jewish words that are helpful for us. In Jewish teaching, there were two kinds of teaching that took place. One was Haggadah, the way of story, the teaching that came through story. And the other one was Halakha, the reasoned, abstract way of thinking. And this came as a commentary out of the Jewish law. Both of those kinds of learning are essential for the Christian faith as we move from Judaism to Christianity. Halakha is the dogmatic kind of systematic kind of way that we put things together, the way we make sense out of a lot of things that are scattered. We put them together. There's no doctrine of the Trinity in the New Testament. There are images, and we kind of mold that so that we can make sense of things. But at times, we have pretended that that is the only way to teach and the only way to think. And so all of it is of that kind, whereas the gospel tradition is in Haggadah. The way Jesus taught, primarily, with rare exception, perhaps in the Gospel of John, is through story. The rabbinic method of teaching through very concrete things. Well, that's important, because often what we have done is we have taken something very concrete and very alive, and we have made it very dull and very abstract. Several years ago, I came across this article in Time magazine. It was a review of the first international symposium on humor. It was held at the University of Wales. And the Time correspondent reports. Sociologist Gary Fine of the University of Minnesota set the tone with his lecture, Humor in Situ, The Role of Humor in Small Group Cultures. As he finished, an American psychologist solemnly asked, "Do you have any observations on the possibility that certain persons are inherently teaseworthy?" Fine confidently responded, "No, I believe the matter is entirely situational, tease-wise." Jargon-wise, the conference was a regular laugh riot. Toronto teacher John Atkin proposed establishing designated unifunctional anxiety relief centers in a community situation. Translated, maybe it would be a good idea to have a string of government-supported laugh parlors where people could go to chuckle. A group of Canadian researchers reported on ethnic humor as a functional social normative incongruity on the basis of multiple dependent variables. The report questioned whether Chinese immigrants found Canadians funny but reached no firm conclusion. Another paper analyzed glee rates of nursery school children. Among its findings, playfulness decreases when kids are made to stand in line. Without a doubt, the U.S. delegates were the top bananas of the conference. Professor Jennings Bryant of the University of Massachusetts tried to explain why the victim of a joke does not usually laugh unless he can think of a halfway witty comeback. It was called Degrees of Hostility and Squelches, featuring retaliatory equity as a factor of humor appreciation. Paul McGee of Fells Research Institute Yellow Springs, Ohio, read an almost incomprehensible dissertation, Phylogenetic and Ontogenetic Considerations for a Theory of the Origins of Humor, referring to intrahumans, arousal fluctuations, and stimulus discrepancies. His conclusion, if you can't think, you won't get the joke. And on the second night, all 180 delegates gathered to hear Liverpool nightclub comedian Ken Dodd get off a few dreadful one-liners. Sample, the Russians are jealous of the British because the Soviets never win any bronze medals. The delegates laughed politely and the next morning repeated the jokes to one another. Observed a woman from New York City, we had a very meaningful humor-making session. Professor Fine, whose current work involves analyzing the jokes of Minnesota Little League team, is anxious to discover why people laugh. When we learn that, we will be able to use humorous material as a tool. Fine believes most people laugh as many as 1,000 times a day. If so, the news should alarm California psychiatrist William Fry, who several years ago developed a theory that laughing is physically harmful and can actually kill you. That might still be a better fate than sitting through an academic conference on humor. Well, we laugh, but what do we do to theology at times? What do we do to gospel stories at times? Again, make sure that I am not suggesting there is no place for theology or systematic theology or any of that. It's just that we have two traditions and often we lose one. And what we need to do is to look at that. We need to look at the gospel tradition of Haggadah because, as Amos Wilder has said, it is not simply a matter of Jesus choosing one among many ways to communicate his gospel message. There was only one way he could have. It had to be a concrete, alive type of thing because the thing he was talking about was concrete and alive. It had to be the kind of language and the kind of methodology that brought forth new visions of a possibility of living. And that, he said, quite frankly, the only way was to use parables, stories, metaphors, and the like. So what is it? What is at risk here, and what we're really talking about is to find a method of communicating the gospel that is, in fact, that can carry the load. Important. Haggadah. Well, in our camps, we probably sometimes teach ideas. At times, we teach things out of the catechism, halakha, but there are times, too, in which we are simply Bible camps, bearers of the story of Jesus. And we need to pass on that story in a variety of ways. Now, interestingly enough, the parables of Jesus are secular stories. That is, there are no references, direct references to God in those stories. The parable of the prodigal son does not mention God. We make an inference, right? We say that that's what he's talking about. Good Samaritan doesn't mention God directly in the story. It's usable. Jesus can use it. Name all of the parables and we see what we mean, which really tells us that for our task, it opens up tremendous possibilities for us and the use of story. There are all kinds of stories that are possible for our use. Today, I want to look at two of those and tell stories around that. Leave the halakha that I've just finished and do some storytelling and suggest some of the things that fairy tales and folk tales have in common with gospel stories. We'll then do some things with biblical storytelling, and I want to simply suggest right off the bat that the other part that I see that could be really great for camping is a telling of biography and great lives. There are probably others, and that's what we'll flesh out in the discussion that we have. But I think for you to have folks in your camp that can tell the stories of the heroes of the faith, and I mean that generically, heroes and heroines, I think would just be a marvelous kind of thing. Well, how do gospel stories relate to fairy tales and folk tales? I think there are several categories in which they are very similar. For one, sin or foolishness is serious. And it's punished. The three little pigs did not live happily ever after Walt Disney, to the contrary. They were consumed. It makes a big difference what you do. Gospel stories say the same thing. Let's tell a story. This one isn't quite like death and all that kind of business, but it makes the point. And I need help. with this particular story. It's a story from the Brothers Grimm. It's called The Fisherman and His Wife. And you have a phrase that you can help me with, if you will. And it goes like this. Fish, oh fish out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. Fish, oh fish out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. Once there was a fisherman who lived with his wife in a tiny little cottage by the side of a great sea. And every day he went out and began to earn his living fishing in the great sea. And one day he caught a gigantic fish, brought it into the boat, was ready to kill the fish. And the fish spoke to him and said he was an enchanted prince and please, wouldn't he save him? Now this man was not about to kill any fish that talked, and he threw him back into the sea. And that night at supper, told his wife of what had taken place. And she said to him, well, what did you ask of the fish? He said, I didn't ask anything. Well, why not? You go back and you tell that fish that you want something. He said, well, what do we need? We have everything we need. No, I've always wanted to live in a nice house. Go back and tell the fish that we want a nice two-story house. And so, reluctantly, he went back. And as he walked down the road, he looked out at that beautiful sea, and it was blue, crystal clear, and calm. And he said, fish, oh fish, out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. And the fish poked its head up and said, what does she want? Well, she'd like a two-story house. Go back. She's in the house. And she was. It was beautiful. Picket fence around the front, apple trees and horses in the back. It was a marvelous house. And he said, Isabel, we have a beautiful house. And she said, we do. Now you must be satisfied. Now we have everything you've ever wanted. She said, no, I've decided that we shall live in a castle. Go back and tell the fish that we want to live in a castle. Well, he decided to go back. And as he walked to the sea, he could see that the sea had begun to turn colors a little murky. And he said, fish, oh fish out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. What does she want? Well, she's changed her mind and she'd like a castle. Go back, she's in the castle. And she was. Oh, the house was much bigger. And there was a turnabout in the front where horses could drive in. There were two servants at the door, and inside a beautiful table spread with food. And Isabel was walking around inside, and he said, Isabel, we live in a castle. Now you must be satisfied. Now you have everything you've ever wanted. And she said, I've decided that you should be king. She said, I don't want to be king. She said, fine, then I'll be king. Go back and tell the fish that I want to be king. And he did. And back he went, and the sea now had turned murky and dark, and the wind began to blow just a little bit, and he said, fish, oh fish out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. What does she want? Well, she'd like to be king. Go back, she is king. And he went back, and Isabel was king. Inside a larger building than ever before, on a throne sat Isabel with a crown on her head. And there were servants running all around, and there was a big, big spread of food. And he said, Isabel, you are king. And she said, I am king. There isn't anything else ever anyone could ever want. Now you're satisfied. She said, I rule over one country, and I desire to rule over many. Go back and tell the fish that I want to be emperor. I won't, I've had it, I won't do any more. As king, I command you. And back he went. And as he went, the sea began to really move and the wind began to blow. And it was not a pleasant smell that came out of the sea. And he said, fish, oh fish out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. What does she want? To be emperor. She is emperor. And she was. Oh, she was on a throne of immense proportion, and down this whole, the whole building, there was food, and now there were servants of every kind and shape, and
And he came in and he was staggered at the sight. Isabel, you are emperor.
I am emperor.
And you were satisfied, right?
Wrong. I've decided to be pope. Oh no, Isabel. The fish can make you king, the fish can make you emperor, but the fish can't make you pope. I command you, go. And he did. And as he went, the wind was blowing and the mist was coming off the sea, and he had to speak a little louder, and he said, fish, oh fish out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. What does she want? Oh, she wants to be pope. She is pope. And she was. Ah, oh, there were cardinals and bishops walking all around in 1,000 candles, and above it all, being carried on the shoulders of the Swiss guard, was Isabel. And he said, Isabel, now there is nothing more you could ever be. Pope, you are pope. And she said, I've decided to be God. Oh, Isabel, as a pope, I know. And back he went. And now the wind was blowing, and as he went, he could hardly make his way, and the wave came up and almost swept him into the sea, and he shouted, fish, oh fish out in the sea, come and hear my humble plea. Isabel, my wedded wife, doesn't like our way of life. What does she want? To be God? Go home. She is in the cottage. And she was. And as far as we know, she is living there still. Well, that's one of but many, and we perhaps later can look at other stories in which both gospel stories and these stories, fairy tales and folk tales, where greed, anger ends up in punishment. And this one, of course, is a marvelous theological one that Brothers Grimm's have pulled together, because it tells us where it all ends, doesn't it? There is another whole theme in the story tales that are just fit hand in glove with the gospel stories. And that is that the entrance to real life is through the leap of faith. Oh, that's the religious word. Let's use the folktale word. It is through risk and through simplicity. Who are the ones who always come out ahead in the gospel story, I mean, in the fairy stories? The older brother? No. The younger brother? The older sister? No. The sibling, the young one that is kind of an innocent in the whole world. And that story of risk and a leap of faith is really a story that fits, again, the themes of the gospel stories. Out of India, a marvelous story called A Grain of Rice. There was once a king who ruled wise and who ruled well. Now the king was loved by all who lived in the land, and the king had as his prized possession his love of his 4 daughters. And one day he brought the 4 daughters before him and said, I'm going on a great journey. And as I go, I leave the kingdom in your hands. Oh, father, they said, everyone loves you. Everyone respects you. No one will allow us to be kings and rule this country. He said, you will do well. And I do not leave you alone. As I go, I give you a gift. And to each he gave a single grain of rice. Now the older daughter immediately went to her room, took the grain of rice, took a silver thread, wrapped it around the grain of rice, and put it into a crystal container, and put it right by her bed where she could look into it every morning and see it, and felt very good about that. And the second daughter took the grain of rice, put it in a wooden box, put it under her bed in a very safe place where it would never be lost, and felt good about that. The third daughter was a pragmatic young lady. She looked at that grain of rice, examined it carefully, and said, this is no different than any grain of rice I've ever seen, and threw it away. The fourth daughter pondered the grain of rice. Why had her father given her, or all of them, a grain of rice? What was the meaning to that? And she thought about it for a day, and a week, and a month, and almost a year, until it dawned on her what the meaning of the gift was. Years passed. The father came home. His beard was full. His eyes had the sparkle of illumination, as if to say he had learned the language of prayer and speaking with God. And he called his daughters before him and asked them to bring his gift to them. Each went to their room and returned. The oldest daughter presented the crystal box and said, "Father, this is the grain of rice that you gave me, and I have looked at it every day since you've been gone." And the father said, "Thank you." And the second young lady came and said, "Father, here is the grain of rice that you gave me. It's right here." And he said, "Thank you." A third daughter ran to the kitchen, found a grain of rice, ran up and said, "Here, father, is a grain of rice." And he smiled and said, "Thank you." And the youngest daughter said, "Father, I don't have the gift that you gave me." Father said, "Whatever did you do with it?" She said, "Well, I thought about that gift. I thought about that grain of rice for almost a year before it dawned on me that grain of rice is a seed. And Father, I planted that seed in the ground, and up came a stalk of grain, and many little grains of rice came from that, and I planted those, and more grew up, and I harvested that crop. And Father, come, look at the window." And they went out, and they looked through the valley as far as the eye could see. Rice, abundant rice, enough rice to feed the whole kingdom. And the father turned to his daughter and said, "You have learned the meaning of rule." And he took his crown from his head and he placed it on his daughter's head. And she ruled in that kingdom. She ruled long, she ruled wise, and she ruled well. And that's the story of the grain of rice. We could spend a lot of time looking at the number of times in which the simpleton or the youngest brother or sister go out into the world and do some marvelous things. We'll move on and we'll look at another theme that's in there, and that is that the stories, the fairy tales and folk tales, are a way of imagining a new world. They are a way of envisioning a new way to live, and so are the gospel stories. The fairy tales and folk tales at the end have a vision. Sometimes we misunderstand. We think that happily ever after is kind of moon, spoon, June, soon type of stuff. You know, but what we have in there is a radical reformation of the world, where the simple end up victorious. And sometimes it's very much like the message of the Sermon on the Mount. A Jewish folk tale called The Two Brothers. There were once two brothers, and they were farmers, and they shared in everything they did equally. They shared in the work, and when they harvested the crop, each took half of the crop and put it in his own warehouse. Now, one of the brothers was married and one was single. And the single brother, one day, thought like this: "It's not fair that we divide the crop 50-50, for my brother has many mouths to feed, and I have only myself. I know what I'll do. Every night, I will take a sack of grain from my granary, and I will take it to my brother." And every night he did. When no one was looking, he picked up the sack of grain, and he snuck across the back, and he put it in his brother's granary. Now his brother began to reason like this: "It's not fair that my brother and I divide the harvest equally. For I have children to take care of me in my old age, and my brother has none. I know what I'll do. I will take a sack of grain from my granary each evening, and I will put it in my brother's." And he did. And the amazing thing, each morning, was each of the brothers would go and look in their granary, and though they had given away a sack of grain, they had exactly the same amount as the night before. And then one night, as they were both making the trip, they met. And they realized what had taken place. And they embraced. And they loved one another. And legend says, God looked down from heaven on that place and said, that is a place of great love. And I call that a holy place. And the legend continues that that is the place where Solomon built the first temple. One other story about in that same line, because those are the fun ones. And they are that whole change and that whole twist. Another Jewish folktale where Dan this morning mentioned about Alexander the Great. And there is a marvelous story called For the Sake of the Animals, of the time in which Alexander the Great had finally conquered all of the kingdoms of the world, and now he was going on a journey. And he went into Africa, and he found himself in a place in Africa that had really known no outside influence. And in this place, he discovered that the people had never known war. He became fast friends with the chief of that tribe, and they both learned each other's languages, and they had marvelous times together. And one day, as they were sitting in there, two men came in asking the chief of the village to settle a dispute. The first one said, I bought a field from that man, and as I was plowing the field, I uncovered a treasure. Now, I bought the field, I didn't buy the treasure, but he won't take it. The other man said, I hope I have my principles. When I sold him that field, I sold him everything in the field. And they argued on. When they finished, the chief listened very carefully, and he summarized the arguments of both. And they both nodded. He had understood. He thought for a moment, and then he said, you have a son? Yes. You have to do that when you're on tape. You have to say yes. And you have a daughter. He agreed that he had. Let your son marry your daughter and give them the treasure as a wedding gift. Oh, they were greatly pleased. And they went away happy. Now, Alexander was puzzled. And the chief said, have I ruled unwisely? Oh, no, 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 no. He said, not at all. It's just that we would have handled it much differently in my country. He said, well, how would you have handled it? He said, well, he said, we would have either taken the gift away from the treasure away from them, or we would have taxed them heavily. Chief thought for a moment, and he said, "Does the sun rise in your country?" He said, "Of course." Does the rain fall? He said, "Yes." Are there animals, wild animals, in your land? Oh, yes, he said. Many animals of a variety of kinds. He said, then that is the reason that the sun shines and the rain falls. The Almighty has sent it for the sake of the animals, for it's certain that the people of your land do not deserve it. Well, there is one more point, and I'll leave that unillustrated for now. But the stories of folk tales and fairy tales, fairy tales particularly, more than the folk tales, but the fairy tales often end or often have about them a marvelous joy. J.R.R. Tolkien has called this eucatastrophe. That is, a good catastrophe. We call it grace. Something that has taken place that no one deserves and no one can even imagine. A radical changing of things. Something that comes into the life and changes the whole life. Eucatastrophe, there is a sense of joy in these stories, and they're compatible with each other. Well, that's one whole form of storytelling. Another whole area that we should look at, because it is the prime area for us, is the whole area of biblical storytelling. We're in a time now, and we won't go at that very in depth, I don't think, now we don't have the time, but I believe that we've gone through a revolution in communication, and we started out as an oral culture. We moved through a variety of kinds of communications, print media, for example, and we went through radio, and we're now back at a very interesting point. We're back to storytelling and oral culture. You don't, when you used to have those radio sermons, you could read it, huh? And therefore, even in our churches, we would read our lessons on Sunday morning. We still do, but we're not supposed to anymore because no one really knows the revolution's taking place. But in television, you can't read anymore, right? How long would Schuller be on the air if he read his sermons? Too long, probably. or any of the other electronic evangelists. Huh? They know, they understand that media calls for a different way of communicating. And it does for us as well. We are back to that. But let's look for a moment at that first century. I'm relying on some investigations and scholarship by Tom Boomershine, who is professor of New Testament at United Seminary in Dayton, who has a doctor's degree on the oral nature of Mark's gospel. He's divided it into stanzas and shows how the whole thing was laid out for oral telling. But he also believes in his research that every person in the early church in the first century, I don't know how long, probably heard most of the stories of Jesus told, and perhaps all in one time. Gospel of Mark takes 2 hours to tell. It's not even the length of a good movie on television. Gospel of Luke takes 2.5 hours. We believe that there were persons who were raised in the Haggadah, that is, who were maybe even set aside to be the storytellers of the community, who probably could tell all of Mark's gospel. We had a man that did it on Broadway not long ago. He did it out of the King James Version of the Bible, shame on him, but he did it not as a storyteller, but as an actor. We are interested now not in acting, we are interested in storytelling. That is, stories that come from within the community and are told within the context of faith. Much, much different. And it's much more freeing for you and I. We are not Laurence Olivier's, but we can tell the story. And we must. And we shall. There are many ways to do that. We have a lot of people that do tell stories, huh? In a variety of kinds. I'm going to suggest two methods. One that you know well, and one that I suggest is a powerful one that we may only be discovering now, and a number of people who got a kick in the pants by Alec McGowan and his Gospel According to St. Mark. We will thank him. He's an instrument of God in my mind. But we'll leave his methodology. Well, I've put my own phrases to the two methods. One I call the adaption method. And that is, you take the story and you put your own words and phrases in there, put it in your own language, and you also at the same time try to move from Jerusalem to Holden Village, or try to move into this century by explaining in the story some of the things that were taking place there that were probably incomprehensible to us. Thus a story like the prodigal son could be told something like this. There was once a man who had two sons. The younger son came to his father and said, "Father, I would like my share of the inheritance." The father divided his property and gave his share of the inheritance to the younger son, who left. And he went to a far country, that is, away from where Jewish people live, for the father and the family were observant Jews. And in the far country, he spent all of his money quickly and soon was broke, and now was forced to find labor himself. He did so by joining himself to a Gentile, a man who did not observe the Sabbath, and the task that he was given was feeding swine. And as he began to feed the pigs, he remembered that old saying that the fathers and mothers of the church had said, "Cursed is he who feeds swine." And he was so hungry that he was delighted to eating those carob pods that they fed the pigs. And then one day he came to his senses and he said, "Even my father's hired servants eat better than this, and they have a better life than this. I know what I'll do. I'll go home and I'll say to my father, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm not worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.'" And so he left. And as he was walking down the path after the long journey home, he could see the father's house, and there was the father sitting on the front porch, dressed as a rich Jewish man was dressed. And then the father saw him, And he did what no rich Jewish man ever did. He ran. He ran to the son, and he embraced him. And the son was ready to fall to his knees, but the father held him up, and he kissed him, not on the cheek like a servant, but on the mouth like a son. And he said, "Bring him a robe and bring him a ring. My son is home." And the son began to say, "But Father, Father, I'm not worthy to be called your son. I've sinned against heaven and before you. Treat me as one of the hired servants." But the father, who had more business to take care of, and he said, "And while you're at it, kill the fatted calf and bring in the musicians. My son, who was lost, is found. We're going to have a party." And the merrymaking began. Now the older son, out in the fields, came home. And he heard the musicians, a rare occasion, and he said, "What's going on here?" He sought out a servant and said, "I don't understand." The servant said, "Haven't you heard? Your brother's home, and your father's having a party in his honor." And the older son said, "Ah! And when he didn't come in after a while, the father missed him, and he came out looking for him. And he said, "What's wrong, my son?" He said, "You know what's wrong. All these years I've stayed home and I've served you. I've been faithful to you. Well, that son of yours has gone off and spent his time with whores and in wild living and hasn't even kept the law. And yet, though I've been home, you've never given me a kid so that I could have a party with my friends." The father's countenance fell and he said, "Son, I thought you knew. All that I have is yours. But don't you understand? Your brother was lost and he's found. He was dead, and now he's alive." Something like that is what we've done with the stories. We've put them in our own words. Although I think if we are really careful about that, putting them in our own words, we've been sure that key phrases were memorized, huh? That we get "the father have sinned against heaven and before you," and those kinds of things, because they are things that carry the story and they have a richness. But, like the people of the early church, there is another way to tell stories, and it's a powerful one. And it's simply to tell the story using the best translations we can, as close to the version that we like. And it's different, but I think, I'm just in the last year beginning to discover what it is, and I don't know where I'm leading with this, but I would like to share a couple things with you. First, a story out of the fourth chapter of Mark's Gospel. At the close of the day, in the evening, Jesus said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowds, they took Jesus with him in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great storm of wind arose, so that the waves were beating into the boat, and the boat was already filling. But Jesus was asleep in the stern on the cushion. And they came to him, and they awoke him, and they said, "Teacher, do you not care if we perish?" And Jesus awoke, and he rebuked the wind, and he said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, "Why were you afraid? Have you no faith?" And they were filled with awe, and they said to one another, "Who then is this that even wind and sea obey him?" I imagine that that would be something like what took place when people read the gospel for the Sunday, as they told that story. Now, quickly, I'll tell you where my experience came. I was ready to do a workshop at a thing called Storytelling in the Religious Message for the United Presbyterians. The last two years they've had conferences, and I was really excited, and I was going to have some things on biblical storytelling. And I ran just before I left, a fellow told me about the Bishop of Saginaw, Ken Utner, who memorizes the gospel every Sunday, and that's his discipline. And he starts on Monday, and by Thursday he has it memorized. And when he stands up front, and the remark people make to him is, "I love the way you put it into your own words. It's so fresh and new." And then when he says, well, it's right out of the RSV, word for word, they say, oh, really? What's happening? Well, I think the word is an oral word. And there's something about that that's vital. The second part of that is I got down to the storytelling conference, and there was Boomershein. And he teaches New Testament by having his students memorize the long narratives, particularly the Passion narrative and also the birth narrative. Passion narrative is required. The birth narrative, I think they have some choice. But he believes that that the main task of understanding New Testament is also being able to tell stories. And so I guess it's a scream. Sally and I know one of the students who said that people are walking across campus saying, you're trying to remember those stories. You hear people muttering all the time walking in little closed circles because that's tested for them. Well, Tom thinks that, and I have been toying with that. I took up as my summer's work last summer to memorize Mark. I got through chapter 7, and then some things began to happen, and I went back to it in the fall, and I had to start over at chapter 2. So I'm not so sure whether I'm going to make it through 16 chapters of Mark or not. But I've heard him do 3/4 of the gospel twice. And my experience was best put by an Anglican priest who was at that and said that he'd heard the story of Jesus for the first time. The man was 55 years old. He said, I heard the story of Jesus for the first time today. I can't do half it. We don't have the time and I don't have the ability. But I do want to give you a chapter because I think we need to begin to hear some things. I'd like to have you at least experience something a little longer than one story at a time. And that'll be the way we'll end and begin the discussion. And that and all the other things, I'd be interested in your reaction. And so this is really chapter 2 of the book of Mark through, it really ends at verse 10 of chapter 3. And when he returned to Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was at home. And many gathered together, so there was no longer room for them, not even about the door. And he was preaching the word to them. And they came, bearing a paralytic carried by 4 men. And when they could not get near to him because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him. And when they had made an opening, they lowered the pallet on which the paralytic lay. And Jesus, when he saw their faith, said to the paralytic, my son, your sins are forgiven. Now there were some scribes sitting there, pondering in their hearts, questioning in their hearts, why does this man speak thus? It's blasphemy. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And Jesus, perceiving in his spirit that they questioned in their hearts, said, why do you question thus in your hearts? What's easier to say to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven, or to say, rise, take up your pallet and walk? But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paralytic, I say to you, rise, take up your pallet, and go home. And he rose, and he took up his pallet, and he went out before them all. And they were all amazed and glorified God, saying, we have never seen anything like this. Now Jesus again went out beside the sea, and a great crowd gathered about him, and he was preaching the word to them. And passing along by the sea, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, follow me. And he rose and followed him. And then one day, Jesus was at home eating, and there were tax collectors and sinners who were eating with him. And the scribes of the Pharisees said to his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but it's those who are sick. I have come not to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, the disciples of John and the Pharisees were fasting. And some people came to Jesus and said, why did the disciples of John and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? And Jesus said to them, when the bridegroom is still with them, can the wedding guests fast? As long as the bridegroom is there, they cannot fast. But one day, The bridegroom will be taken from them, and on that day they will fast. Listen, no one takes an unshrunk piece of cloth and sews it on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wines will burst their skins, and the wine will be lost, and so will the skins. But new wine is for fresh skins. On the Sabbath, Jesus was making his way through the grain fields. And as they went, the disciples plucked ears of grain. And the Pharisees came and said to him, "Why do your disciples do that which is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And Jesus said, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he went into the temple when Abiathar was high priest and ate the bread of the presence which was not lawful for any to eat but the priests? And how he shared it with all of those who were with him? Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." And immediately he went into the synagogue. And there was in the synagogue a man with a withered hand, and they watched him carefully to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath. And Jesus said to the man with the withered hand, "Come here." And then he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill?" And they were silent. And Jesus grew angry, and he grieved at their hardness of heart. And he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And the man stretched it out, and it was restored. And immediately the Pharisees went out and took counsel with the Herodians against him, that they may destroy him. The Gospel of the Lord. Well, those are some things. 5 minutes longer than I thought it would take for this. Let's just get reactions to this. Anything else on the fairy tales or how you're doing things in camp or possibilities or whatever else? Paul.
What do you do in the middle of a story and you lose it?
Pray.
No, I'm sure that as you get started doing that thing, I know with songs, you know, you get halfway through a song and you forget the line. I've had experience of making up a line, hoping that it's going to rhyme at the end of the next line. There's an element of risk of getting into it, of first starting to say, "I'm going to do storytelling."
Yep.
And then you got to cover for yourself if, in fact, you lose it.
Well, I don't think most folks are going to be telling the memorized story. I really believe that they're going to go with the adaption. I'm not sure I think that's good or bad or what. But first of all, you remember you're not a performer. I'm not entertaining folks. And so within community, it's okay to say, "I forgot." Who was that person that did that marvelous thing on Sunday night and said, "I missed it. Can you give me the note all over again?" We loved him, didn't we? Every one of us? Wasn't that great? I mean, that's what you do when you're in community. You say, "I missed it. Let's start over again." And that's what you do with storytelling. You're not performing for anyone. You are telling a story within the community. And the nicest thing is that when you finish, you move back to another position. So storyteller's here, then I move over there and somebody else sits here. And that's the new person who is in there, because we're sharing and not being in charge. And the stories don't belong to us. Just like the songs, most of your songs. Some you wrote. But most stories, even in the story too. Well, you find that with a song. If you write a good one, then people begin changing it on you, right? And the same with a story. The story doesn't, once you tell it, it's gone. It doesn't belong to you anymore.
I heard somebody just last week do some stories from Luke, and she had somebody right in front of her that had the Bible. And she did forget about twice, and she just looked at this lady, looked cuter, and she went right on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one possibility.
Yeah, I think there are probably lots of ways to do that. If I did that, if I wasn't sure, I'd open the Bible up and look myself. We tell for intimacy, don't we? That's why. I mean, it's try telling those stories to your kids. They don't care one whit if you don't get it quite straight. They'll love you for it. And storytelling, you see, is always one-to-one. It's the most intimate way of communicating. And you do it from the heart as well as from the head. And that's why we want to drop that book. Anytime you put anything between yourself and the audience, you take away a little bit. Whether it's distance, height, a book, And I, by the way, am not one who believes in, I think it's fine when people do that, but I think that even the visual aids get in the way. Sketches and all the other things. Let the mind imagine. Let the mind go. Create the picture with the words. And if I have to, I try to present a picture. I ran into a snag. I was telling the story of Martin Luther. Every year we have done this for 6 years now on Reformation Sunday, and I did it because I found out my kids didn't know who he was, and I also found out that when they were really confused the first time I told it, they thought he was black. So I decided we got to make sure they understand this is not Martin Luther King, and so I showed a picture very quickly of who he was, and then I put it down. But I think if you do have pictures, if you really think that's necessary, make them real abstract, so the kids can fill in as much as they can with their mind, or not kids, all of us can do that. I think that's much better.
In the camping setting, for us, anyway, the mime or clown type thing has been a really good way of telling stories.
And you run the same risk with mime and clown that you begin performing rather than serving, right? That's the risk in the storyteller. You got to remember this difference between drama, performance, and this, in the same way that the mime and the clown are, if they're done within the community of believers and worship, they're not doing things for them, they're doing them with them. It comes out, yeah. I think that is. And I think that sometimes we can challenge them to really work on stories more, too. Yeah.
I overheard you talking about using storytelling in school setting the other day. Can you just say more on that kind of teacher?
Well, I just was saying, I don't think there's any subject you can't tell stories with. History. I was saying one day, we were laughing with a crowd at church or someplace, and we said, maybe you can't do the sciences by telling stories. The guy said, oh, just a second, he said. We got a biologist that does that. She takes people out. The first day, she looks at a tree, and she tells them the history of Isabella County by looking at that tree. You know, first of all, there's this big thing happened with the wind of such and such a time and so on. Well, she just goes through the whole cycle, and she has to guess some places, obviously, but she can show where it got deformed here and where this happened there. There's virtually nothing that we can't do with story, and I think it's a very freeing medium for us. There's just all kinds of possibilities once we finish with it as well. And what I want to do, I tell the teachers in my church school, you are not to teach them a great deal of morality. I hope that you do, but that's not your major goal. And no great truths. I want you, at this age, to leave the kids with a story. When you finish, you don't even have to interpret it. You may not even understand it yourself. Just leave them with a story. If they know the story, it will come back. Just like all those stories we learned as kids. We'll come back.
Yeah, say that's at camp, Bill. You know, I do a lot with 8-12-year-olds. How do you follow up on a story? If you want response, I mean, if you were doing that story for 8-12-year-olds with a prodigal son, how would you begin a discussion with 6-7 kids that were listening to you in the story? I'd like to know your style.
Well, I would answer any questions about what did you say, and not necessarily to begin with, what did it mean. I may ask them a question. Have you ever been angry with a brother or sister before? Have you ever felt jealous? Why? Have you ever felt like you were a long way away from home, physically or some other way? I don't know. I do something like that.
But you're not. You are saying that it's okay to continue the.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
You just don't walk away from the story.
No.
Catch it.
No. Yeah. It's okay to walk away too. That too, and then maybe come back later. The story is going to leave them. The lecture, maybe the story. The story is going to stay there, and you can tell it in the dining hall, and then pick it up later in the day. You may just have one person be the storyteller for that story. You start the day with that, and then you kind of peck away at it.
We often act it out later in the day as part of that.
Yeah. I think that's grand. I want to make sure that the images are there, and what they remember is not the acted out one. I want to make sure that that's embedded in their mind so that some of those phrases remain. That's what I hope. And I think all the other things we do then are great. If I were going to take a staff through quickly through staff training on this, I would make a quick rationale for storytelling. It doesn't take very much. I would read them a list of some things to do and some things to avoid. I have that list in the book I wrote, Speaking in Stories. It's about 2 pages. My list, somebody else's list can be used. There are a lot, almost all storytellers in their books have got some phrase in there about what to do and what not to do or some such thing. And mine's the best, but there are some people that are okay. Okay. And then I would simply have everybody pick out a story and tell them to practice. The only thing I insist is you practice out loud. We don't want any of this moving the lips type of stuff. This is an oral art and we're going to practice orally. And get them out and practice it, and then bring them back and tell them and have it told in 2s or 3s, and then have a festival of storytelling. Have the whole, everybody in the camp tells a story. Cooks, janitors, anybody who comes to meetings, if they want. But everybody, because that point is made, we're all storytellers, right? And let them all tell a story that night, and then go work on the next one. But you've got to have an audience. It doesn't really do well until you've told 2 or 3. Good singers, you can practice all you want at home, but until you've gone in front of the audience a couple times, and that's what you find. Sooner or later, you kind of shake it down like that. Also, there are some books, and we can talk about other resources for where you find other kinds of stories. I can do that privately with you. In the back of Speaking of Stories, there is a bibliography, and the book that I think is the best of the whole lot is one that is one on Jewish folktales. It just came out in paperback. It wasn't even when we did this. It's called A Treasury of Jewish Folklore, Stories, Traditions, Legends, Humor, Wisdom, and Folk Songs of the Jewish People. I'll leave this out. That's too much for you to write down right now. But it's on 122 here, and I think it's just a great treasury. Just really marvelous. We don't have enough of it, so I hope to put some together myself.
Where did we get your book, Bill?
They had some, 8 at noon, and if they run out, I'd be glad to supply you with one right now. I mean, later, after they run out, I've got a few with me. If not, Augsburg should have many. Thousands, probably, of unsold copies.
What's the name of it again?
The book is called Speaking in Stories.
Just a quick one here. You've been very true to the gospel story form. You know, and you mentioned about keeping those key phrases and everything. Then you really don't recommend kind of the modern parable at all.
I don't. I don't think they last. I don't think they endure. They're too hip, and they don't carry the weight. Words are magic. Words carry tremendous freight. And I don't want to monk. If I do change words, I really want to be careful. It's not the essential ones. And I think it, after they know the other story, then it's okay for the other one. But I want to make sure they know the real one first before we get. Hey, there was a cool dude walking down the road, man, and you know. Later, after we know it.
Do you have any quick hint for people who are intimidated by memorizing?
Yeah. I do talk about that a little bit. Don't memorize. Don't do the memory stuff. Do the other one, and you don't have to memorize it. Read it 15 times, and you'll tell it just like you tell stories of your grandchildren. And make sure you're using your living room voice. You're not performing, you still may get diarrhea. I don't know, but it still may be terrifying. But I think that will help. Don't think of performing. You're just simply.
You said sometimes you stand up. Would you have done that, like in the middle of a?
There are a couple of stories I normally have to stand up for. I'd like to be on eye level, but I can't see. For example, I can't see Carl back there, and I always want to see the eyes. And so, that's the major goal is to be able to make contact because it's an intimate art. And if you can't see people, then do something so you can.